Welcome to Dialogue on Teaching, Wabash Center's podcast series. I am Nancy Lynn Westfield, director of the Wabash Center. Paul Myrie and Paul Utterback are in the sound engineer's booth. It is my pleasure to welcome to the conversation today Sophronia Scott. Sophronia Scott is director of the Masters of Fine Arts and Creative Writing program at Alma College in Alma, Michigan. She is also a prolific author. She has written Wild, Beautiful, and Free, that's her latest novel. Also, look for The Seeker and the Monk, Everyday Conversations with Thomas Merton, Love's Long Line, a collection of essays, This Child of Faith, written with her son, Tane Gregory, and other novels and essays. Now, the reason why I'm going on is because she is one of my dearest friends. So welcome, Sophronia, the author, the friend, the writer. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome, Lynn. I'm always happy to be in conversation with you.
So you and I have been working for many years, and it has turned into many years, yes. Right? To assist scholars to write more creatively, to write better, for their writing to be more accessible.
Yes.
So tell us what you have learned while teaching scholars to write better.
Well, first of all, let's go back to when we first met. And you told me that scholars needed help with this. And I did not believe you. Because
both of those things happen. I did say that. And you're like, nah, they're fine. I'm like, we are not fine.
Don't they write all the time?
Yes, we write all the time. And we write obtusely. We write inaccessibly. We write the way we were trained to write. And that is for the narrow sliver of scholars in our own fields that can only read our jargony language.
Yes. So I thought, and then going into it, right, doing our first workshops, I thought it would be that I would be dealing with writers along the lines of what I had experienced coming out of journalism. So, you know, I was a corporate journalist, so to speak. I wrote for Time Magazine, People Magazine, and those magazines under the Time Inc. empire had a very specific way of writing, right? There was the Time voice, and I had to learn to write a very specific way. But at the same time, it was a tremendous study in how to write. You know, I had to write things that were extremely short. I learned how the power of verbs. I also worked with extremely tough editors. So coming out of that and moving more into creative writing, the change in process wasn't that difficult for me, especially when it came to editing, because I felt like, you know, I know this. I've already been through editing. I know there's certain things I just don't take emotionally or personally because it is the work. You know, I'm doing the work. And I thought working with scholars that it would be that we would be coming from the same springboard, that they had already done some writing, that they've been through edits and other reviews of their academic work, and that they would come with a certain amount of craftsmanship in mind, and that we would be working at it as craftspeople. What I didn't expect was the level of insecurity and emotion. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. It was just unexpected that that they felt tied up, if anything, in a certain way, by the conventions of academic writing, and also the bad experiences that they've had in receiving feedback for that writing. So it felt like so many of them didn't behave as though they had permission to write any differently. There was no confidence. I wouldn't say no confidence in voice, because they hadn't been trained yet to develop a voice, but just even the idea that they could have their own voice, right, was kind of bewildering, it seemed, to them. So it seemed to me that there were hurdles that we had to overcome from the jump, just to get even before talking about writing, that we have to get them to a place to say, you know, it's okay to do this.
So a lot of our work has been spent in permission giving, right? Permission to make mistakes, permission to let whatever that voice is on the inside of you actually come out on the page, mm-hmm. permission to allow yourself to be edited and not take it personally. Mm-hmm. And the reason why, before I was director of Wabash Center, and certainly since I've been director of Wabash Center, I'm so interested in our partnership and in this problem is, and I am going to call it a problem, is because so many scholars are required to teach and write as part of our employment, as part of our scholarly jobs, as part of being on faculty. Mm-hmm. There are at least two things that in our formation, in our PhD programs, as well as in our formation early on faculties that we are not trained in is teaching and writing. So there's a kind of absurdity to require us on such high levels to do these two tasks. And on the other hand, Wabash Center in bringing you to our colleagues to teach this skill better deeply affects teaching, right? If you can be a better writer, you are a better teacher.
Yes.
Good teachers pay attention to their writing, right? Those things go hand in hand. We're not separating those two things away from each other. We're saying you build one, you build the other.
Exactly. You're learning how to formulate ideas, but also it opens up the discussion of how you express these ideas, both for yourself and with the students, right? The students get to feel permission in their own way, right? To feel that they can have a back and forth, right? And I feel that that's what you're doing on the paper creatively, right? It's not just you're putting down, this is what I've studied or this is the way things are. It's opening a conversation, inviting the reader into a story.
So the myth of scholarly writing is not creative, is not creative nonfiction or even creative fiction. Is one of the things, one of the constant questions that comes up in the workshops. Talk about creative nonfiction or the fact that we have so boldly and wrongly said scholarly writing is not creative.
Yeah, and it seems like scholarly writing has been pushed to a place to make it specifically not look like creative writing, right? From what I understand, the use of I, right, is discouraged. The use of the passive voice in writing to say this was done instead of saying they did this, right, is apparently the convention in academic writing. But with scholarly writing, creative nonfiction specifically, and I used to say, you know, because before I got my MFA, I didn't know the term creative nonfiction myself. And I said, I always say that sounds like something I would have been fired for when I was a journalist, you know. But all it means is that you're bringing to nonfiction the tools of fiction, right? Not in terms of making something up, but in terms of thinking, in terms of writing with detail, using dialogue, description, setting scenes, in other words, telling a story from your work. I was recently in a discussion about this, and we were talking about Oliver Sacks, for example. And he was, you know, studied the brain, right? He was a neurobiologist writing about some of the most complicated studies of our time and how the brain works. And yet his writing was so compelling that it was turned into a Hollywood movie. Right? Because he knew it was about the story, not just the science.
So much of the conversations that you and I have with colleagues, rather than, and I think out of fear, rather than leaving the big questions on the table, like how do I develop my voice? What is my voice? How do I become a better descriptor of the stories I'm trying to tell, right? I found all those conversations very exciting, very compelling. Invariably, the first day will be spent until you can redirect people to how long should I write? What should, you know what I mean? They try to reduce writing to tips, tricks, and techniques.
Yeah, but also, Lynn, I thought where I thought you were going with this is the issue of what can I do with this, right? Because if it's not going to be acceptable for my tenure track, right, portfolio, why should I spend the time on this?
Why should I spend the time on this? It's not gonna help me politically. and building the muscle of creativity has little use. The assumption is building the muscle of creativity has little use in my scholarship.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if the change for that, right? Instead of saying to them, well, you can use it for X, Y, and Z, why can't we change what scholarly writing looks like? You know, which is what you're leaning towards with the journal on teaching, right? And I've told you that I've, you know, recently been in discussions and in study with writers in the UK where the things that we're talking about are acceptable in scholarly writing. And if anything, it's encouraged, right? So to not sound didactic and archaic, right? Mm-hmm. To really help yourself be understood, to write with some level of style, right? So I'm wondering if, you know, how do we change that conversation around academic writing here to have it be more expansive?
More expansive and more interest, just more interesting.
Yeah.
A pursuit of our own curiosities rather than our made up expectations by people who aren't in the room in some kind of way, right?
Yeah,
so we have
yeah.
colleagues who say, once I get past this dissertation and get out of this PhD program, then I'm going to write what I want. Then we have colleagues who say, once I get past this tenure process, I'm going to write what I want. And then they discover by the time they get into that, they can't write what they want because they haven't worked on what they wanted.
No, no. And they don't know how because they've been writing in this arcane way. Right.
So what's good writing? Sophronia, what's good writing? So, and I ask that because you are an exquisite writer. So what's good writing? And I'm not saying there's one way to be a good writer, but help us understand in thinking about, if we're going to make some of these pivots, what are we aiming at, right? We know what we're pivoting from.
Right.
Help us know what we're pivoting toward.
Well, we want to draw the reader in, right? We want the person to be interested in what we're writing and to stick with us, right? So I'm going to read, for example, I was just looking at an example of, you know, I don't want to say bad writing, but it does articulate what is going on when you have academic writing, right? So here's a sentence. One potential explanation for these mixed results is that numerous methodologies have been employed to assess the diagnostic tools, but they may not be assessing diagnosis at the same stage. Right? I can barely read that, let alone understand what the person is saying.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
that's what we mean by obtuse, right? When people attempt to be obtuse in their writing.
Right. And you're not bringing the reader in. You're not inviting them in. Right. If anything, it feels like you're keeping them away.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, good writing is compelling.
It's compelling. I've actually had students trying to mimic what they think that is.
Yes.
So they put down their own voice. They put down their own communication style and then try to mimic. And the mimicry actually reveals just how lacking and hollow those kinds of sentences that you read really are.
Yeah. And you know, it goes both ways. Like sometimes you have writers who learn some things about creative writing, but then they fill it up with what they call, you know, flowery language, mm-hmm. thinking that now they're writing well, but really doesn't say anything. Yeah. Right. So it's getting the writer to be really connected to what they want to say, but then making good choices, right, to help them create compelling work.
So many colleagues have been, and you mentioned this, wounded about their writing, told that their scholarship is not worthwhile nor valuable based on chapters that they've sent or manuscripts that they've sent. They've sent manuscripts in and they've come back with blind peer review, which I find unethical and morally reprehensible to say I'm being critiqued by someone who won't tell me their name, which I think it's a form of bullying. And that's why our journal no longer does blind peer review. But so many people have been wounded by those acts. So then in our workshops, when we try to with compassion and still and generosity, but still saying you can improve, it's tough going to get people to allow themselves to be critiqued and also to critique other people.
Yes. Yeah, because they don't want to cause the same kind of hurt. Right. But but that's another thing that we work on, right? Is just how to give feedback. What is useful feedback? Right. And to let them know, here's what you're looking for. And it's okay if you're not seeing it, right? If a piece is not drawing you in, there's something that the writer needs to know about that. And you are doing them a favor to help them with that as concisely as possible. But there's, you know, this pain thing is so prevalent, right? And it's so hard to figure out even just sometimes where to begin to unravel it all.
We've been a part of, witnessed, held spaces for people who are in tears over both positive feedback and negative. There have been an equal amount of tears about positive feedback as there have been about negative feedback. So when people hear the encouragement and the accolades from a job well done, it's breathtaking for people, not life-giving, but oftentimes breathtaking for people.
Yes. And I find that thrilling. It's so thrilling because I can't wait to see the work that's going to come from that. Right. Because I like to say, okay, this is not about a book. This is about books. Right. It's about taking hold of the sense that you have something to say in the world, right? Not just about your scholarship, but in whatever's happening in the news, whatever's happening in your neighborhood, and whatever's happening in your office, right? Just to be able to write and express yourself in a way that others will be changed by that light, by that expression.
So as I hear the listeners saying, yeah, get on with it. The listeners want to know what your creative process is. So as an artist, as a creative, as a teacher, what's your writing process?
So it's different between working on fiction and nonfiction. So when I'm writing nonfiction, I tend to be answering a question. So the Thomas Merton book. So I just happen to be in a realm where I came to the realization that people don't know how to read Thomas Merton, right? They're intimidated by him. They're flummoxed by him. But to me, you know, reading through his journals, he's just an everyday guy dealing with the same stuff that we're dealing with now. So let me write a book and show you how I read Thomas Merton. With fiction, I am usually fascinated by a story. And then I see in that story a way to comment on something that I feel that's going on in the world. So I sometimes say, you know, when I really have something to say about the world, I will use fiction because it goes down easily, you know, like a parable. So with my creative process, you know, I have to be interested in it, right? So if I'm not compelled by it, then I know I'm not going to write something that's interesting. So I definitely follow what's in my heart, but I'm also in an exploration process. So right now I'm working on a new novel and I understand the general idea of it, but this week I was working on and it's in the first person, it's going to be all of these different first person voices, but this one is, you know, this I'm writing from the point of view of a young man who's about to become a fighter pilot in World War II. And I'm figuring out his voice, but the whole time I'm writing this, I feel like he's somebody who's like standing in the fog, like he has not yet revealed himself to me. I don't know him. And I feel like I'm writing about a stranger. Right. So, but I'm going to keep going. I'm at the beginning of this process. But the idea is that as I keep going, I'm going to know more about this person. He's going to start, maybe things will start clicking. Maybe he's going to remind me of somebody I went to high school with, like, or maybe he's going to say something that will connect him to me in another way. And it's like, ah, okay, I know you. All right, then. Okay, now we're going to go from here. And so it's like a constant digging. Someone just said to me today, though, it's like the interesting thing about writers is that we don't, you know, I was talking about the difference between writing and rewriting. So to me, rewriting is so much easier because, you know, the blank page is the hardest thing, which is what I've been doing this week. I've been dealing with the blank page, conjuring this guy. And someone said to me, you know, we are artists, but it's not like, but it's almost like if we were sculptors, it's like we have to make our own clay. Right? We can't just scoop up the clay and put it down there and go to work. We have to make the clay before we even get to the sculpting part. Mm-hmm. So, which is difficult, but I'm in this exploration process. I have a general idea and I do have an outline of what I want the story to be, but I have to put words down to figure out where the story is going. And I think that's something that stops a lot of people. They think they have to know everything before they sit down to write. And they think they have writer's block, when really all it is you don't know yet what you're doing. And you won't know until you start just throwing something on the page. And it's okay if it's not good, right? That's another thing that stops people. They think, well, I have to work it all out and it has to be perfect on the page. And they write a sentence and throw it out, write a sentence and throw it out. But you can put anything on the page, which is easier to do in this day of computers. It's not like you're having to type something out. I still write a lot by hand, in fact, especially with fiction. But you have to put that clay, you have to make that clay and put it on the wheel before you realize what you can make of it.
I also think like so many other genres of art, and maybe even life, you have to be around other writers.
Yeah.
Right? You have to be around people who understand what you're attempting to do, not the project itself, but the activity of writing.
Yeah.
And to having, even if you're not talking about the project you're writing on, to be around and networked with and in conversation with other people who are in that similar kind of artistic struggle makes all the difference in the world.
Exactly. And they can make suggestions that you never would have thought of, right? If you're talking about it, you know, I was, and this is pertaining to this character. I was with friends in Chicago recently, and one of them commented on the faith aspect that sometimes shows up in my work, and he's an atheist. And this got me to thinking, you know, and he was talking about how unusual it is for him to often find his atheism, you know, represented in fiction. And I thought that was unusual in terms of, I never thought to create a character who is an atheist, number one. And number two, you know, I have two friends whom I love dearly who are atheists, and they are the most alive people that I know. And now suddenly I have this idea in my head, which I would not have had before if I had not been in conversation with them. It's like, okay, I'm going to make this character an atheist. So not only is he a white guy that I have no idea who he is, he's also an atheist, which is very strange to me. So, all right, here I go. But that's exciting to me, even though I don't know what I'm doing. It's exciting to me. And I never would have come to that if I had not been in conversation, in community with someone else who read and is interested in stories and writing.
Is this the book that you thought of or that came to you at Chautauqua when we were in Chautauqua this summer?
No, although we talked about that one too.
Yeah, we did.
So I haven't started work on that one yet. But yeah, that's the climate one that I'm thinking about. Yeah.
So to our listeners, Sophronie and I were sitting in Chautauqua at a lecture and she kind of quakes, right? And she's like, I got my next novel. Yes, it has happened. The muse has visited.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And then we went to lunch.
Yeah. I wrote it down.
So if, for the scholars who don't have any other writers to talk to, who feel like they're alone, we encourage you, one, to sign up for Sophronia's annual creative writing workshops with us at the Wabash Center, which the application process will go up in January or so. Because now it's an annual workshop that she and Donald Quist teach together. But also, if somebody wants to get started, if somebody wants to, like, I was disdainful of tips and tricks. Now I'm back to tips and tricks. Who help? What should people do? How do we start?
Read, first of all. read outside of your outside of academy, right? So what do you love? You know, what writing is striking to you? So that's first. Second of all, there's already a story that's inside of you that's bugging you in one way or another, right? So can you just sit, and maybe you can find it just by journaling, because I find that if you write regularly in that way, just journaling, you will find that you're talking about the same thing over and over again, and that you kind of have a bee in your bonnet about something. And that's the place to begin, right? And it's not necessarily going to be what you think. I know some people like want to tell the story of their grandmother going somewhere, or, you know, they have this story about something that happened to somebody else. But really, there's something that you are deeply connected to that is not as complicated as you think, right? To start there. And I find myself going through that process every time I'm invited to write something for a publication, usually an anthology. And my first thing is, oh, I want to give the editor what he or she wants. Okay, what are you looking for in this book? And what is the idea behind it? There's a book that came out about turning 40. And so I started off asking all of these questions, but then I stopped myself. I was like, you know, wait a minute. I'm bugged about wasting time and people wasting my time. And I feel that as I get older, I am less willing to put up with that. And so right away, I was like, never mind. I know what I'm going to write. And I wrote this essay called "I Don't Have Time for That." Right. Because that was the thing. That was the thing that was already under my skin. Right. So just start there. And when you do that, you're not committing yourself to a book or a memoir, right? That's just an essay, right? That's just an essay. That may not even be 5,000 words, but to start with a true expression of something that's on your mind right now. And the funny thing is that when you do that, and that was what I did when I wrote the first time when someone encouraged me to write essays, that first essay that I wrote was published online. And when I saw all of the comments on it, I realized that the people weren't necessarily commenting on the essay. They were writing about themselves. Because when you, and I've said this before, you heard me say this in class, that when you write truthfully enough about your own story, you hit this note and it resonates and people start seeing themselves in the work. And it's not, you know, they're not reading about you. They're reading and thinking about themselves. Right. And I've seen that also with my latest novel, with Wild, Beautiful and Free. And even, that's a historical fiction. Right. That's about a mixed race girl. It's the 1850s and going into the Civil War. And yet, if you look at some of the Amazon reviews, there are people who are reading that book over and over again because there's something about themselves that they're trying to work through, about identity, about forgiveness. Right. They see themselves in that book, even though they're nowhere, you know, nothing like that girl or the times.
And they are moved by it, right? Yeah. They're moved by your portrayal to do the reflection, to do the wondering, to be curious in new ways about themselves and their life and whatever this is that we're doing.
Yeah.
In scholarship and beyond scholarship.
Yeah.
Sophronia Scott, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're welcome.
As always,
Lynn.
Right?
Yes.
We always have fun together. So yes, come back anytime.
Okay. I shall.
To our listeners, the Wabash Center website is the place. Look on our website to find information about our cohort groups, our resources on teaching, like our blogs, our journal on teaching, our syllabi collection, as well as all of our podcasts. And there's information on our website about our regranting program. A special thanks to podcast producer Rachel Mills, and the music which frames our podcast is the original composition of Paul Myrie. Wabash Center for more than 28 years is exclusively funded by Lilly Endowment Incorporated. And we are out. How was that, Paul?